Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. I am delighted to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Rose Braz, who is the Climate Campaign Director for the Center for Biological Diversity's Climate Law Institute. Rose coordinates the center's climate campaign and organizing work. The Center for Biological Diversity can be found online at biologicaldiversity.org. Rose Braz, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much for having us on. We really appreciate it.
I'm glad you could be here. Just briefly tell us about the Center for Biological Diversity.
Sure. Well, the center is now over two decades old, and our core mission is to protect endangered and threatened species and the ecosystems they call home. We see the web of life as integral to both ecological well-being and human well-being, and so we do work across the country and internationally to save and protect species from the polar bear to the little pika, which lives up at high altitudes here in California and is threatened by climate change.
And the Climate Law Institute, I've seen on your website, has had some significant successes already thus far. Is that right?
Absolutely. So the Climate Law Institute is just almost a decade old. And the basic strategy we've been using is to use our existing environmental laws to try to reduce global warming pollution. We know that people fought long and hard for laws like the Endangered Species Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, and the Clean Air Act. And these laws are powerful tools to protect our environment, and if we use them ambitiously and urgently, we can do quite a lot to reduce global warming pollution right now, today. And so possibly what we're best known for is getting the polar bear listed as a threatened species due to climate change. We've also had key roles in some of the legal cases around reducing greenhouse gas pollution from motor vehicles and many other avenues all along the basic strategy of using these hallmark environmental laws to address this emerging crisis of climate change.
So I called you because I saw that Charlottesville, Virginia, where I live and am speaking from, was the 71st city or locality in the United States that you had gotten to demand that the government use the Clean Air Act. I think you may be at 72 already at the point that we're speaking today. When did this particular campaign start, and what is the strategy here?
Sure. Well, we believe that of our current laws on the books, the Clean Air Act is our current best hope to reduce greenhouse gas pollution. And we already have the Supreme Court, this U.S. Supreme Court, you know, ruling that the Clean Air Act applies to greenhouse gas pollution. We have, subsequent to that historic ruling, we have the Obama administration coming in and making what was called an endangerment finding, which is part of the Clean Air Act, finding that greenhouse gas pollution does pose a danger to public health and welfare. And from there, the Environmental Protection Agency has begun to use the Clean Air Act to reduce greenhouse gas pollution from vehicles, from very large stationary sources, and just recently proposed some rules to deal with power plants, existing future power plants. So we are seeing all of this take place, and at the same time, as we all know, there's a big anti-regulatory backlash. There are forces who don't want any regulation from the government, who are after the EPA, who don't see climate change as a real problem. And all of these forces are combining to harm, really, the path of the Clean Air Act, and it's having an impact on the Obama administration, which is moving, but not moving as ambitiously and urgently as science demands. So what we've put together is a campaign we call Clean Air Cities, and the goal is really to demonstrate that, contrary to what you might believe from reading some of the press, there is a broad base of support for using the Clean Air Act to reduce greenhouse gas pollution. And these 71, and now you're right, 72 cities, ranging from Detroit to Miami, to now Charlottesville, are coming together and saying, we support use of the Clean Air Act to reduce greenhouse gas pollution.
So how did the Clean Air Act ever get passed in the first place? And in summary, what has been its history over the decades?
The Clean Air Act is 40 years old, and it is our most successful law for reducing pollution. It has been tremendously successful in reducing the pollutants covered under the Clean Air Act anywhere between over 40% to 90%. We've seen things like airborne lead virtually eliminated due to programs like the Clean Air Act. So we've seen thousands of lives saved. We've seen cost savings, cost benefits analysis show tremendous savings from use of the Clean Air Act in terms of obviously prevented death, health care costs, preventing lost days of work and school. So the Clean Air Act is an extremely successful law that we know how to use for many different pollutants and is now being, you know, used towards the towards greenhouse gas pollution. And the Clean Air Act was implemented along with laws like the Endangered Species Act and others about 40 years ago, actually signed into law by Richard Nixon, who felt the pressure of a movement, a really grassroots, broad-based movement of people across the U.S. who said, we need to protect our environment. We need to protect the air we breathe, the water we drink, the ecosystems, and the species that call those communities and areas home. So all of during this period, you saw bipartisan and actually signed by Richard Nixon laws like the Clean Air Act and the Endangered Species Act. So they come from grassroots pressure to address these problems.
Do you think that happened because there was simply greater grassroots pressure, or because we had a better communication system and less money buying elections and all sorts of other factors? Or why do you think such a thing could be created under President Nixon and we wouldn't dream of it now?
I do think a lot of it is due to grassroots pressure, and that's why we at the center, you know, devote a good substantial part of our resources toward continuing to build the grassroots movement that will demand this kind of change. And the Clean Air Cities campaign is an example of that. We're working with advocates across the country to get these resolutions passed. So definitely that played a part in it. I mean, obviously there are other factors that 40 years ago, you know, created a different environment that allowed this bipartisan agreement. But I do think that the key in moving forward is really to build back that kind of grassroots, broad-based pressure that demanded action from our elected leaders. And that's what we're trying to do with this campaign and others.
So you have over 70 big cities and small towns and growing, and presumably you want more, demanding that the EPA make better use of the Clean Air Act. Now, does the EPA just have permission to do what you want, or does it have a legal responsibility to do what you want?
It actually has the legal responsibility to move once the finding was made that these greenhouse gas pollutants like carbon dioxide, methane, et cetera, pose a threat to our health and welfare. And there is no doubt, you know, with the fact that I'm sure your listeners have seen some of the sea level rise maps that show basically a large portions of Florida and the East Coast from where you are, underwater. We know that there are more intense storms like Hurricane Irene and Sandy, of course, coming down the pipeline due to climate change. We see the threat of more heat-related days. I was just in the Southwest for a conference that projected 30 more days in Arizona of temperatures between 100 and 110, and we all know what heat and heat stroke and those are the threats that poses, particularly to vulnerable populations like the elderly and others who may not have resources for air conditioning, etc. So once that finding was made that these pollutants do threaten health and welfare, the EPA really does need to act. And the other thing that I think is important to note is this U.S. Supreme Court is the pathway to where we got today. And we all know that the U.S. Supreme Court is not a radical body. hell-bent on regulating every activity out there. Quite the opposite, in fact. So all of these things, you know, are out there, and yet I don't believe, you know, part of the goal of this campaign is to really increase public awareness of the Clean Air Act, of the crisis of climate change, and of the tool we have to really lessen its impact in the Clean Air Act. So I think we're succeeding at those goals community by community, you know, from Chicago to Boone, North Carolina, to Teton County, Wyoming. We just added Honolulu as our latest clean air city. So you're really seeing, you know, a broad base of support from industrial cities, cities, you know, it's interesting to me that California has the most clean air cities, the cities that have the greatest number of cities that have passed these resolutions. But in second place is Florida. And Florida is not a place you think of as favoring heavy regulation. You know, if you think about Florida, you don't think that. But the reality is Florida communities know the threat of climate change. They're feeling it. They're seeing it. And they are begging, you know, for a solution to address the crisis, and they are agreeing that the Clean Air Act is one key way we can reduce the impacts of climate change if we use it urgently and ambitiously.
Any time that reality enters into U.S. politics, you know you're onto something big. We're speaking with Rose Braz, who is the Climate Campaign Director for the Center for Biological Diversity's Climate Law Institute. The website is biologicaldiversity.org. You would think, just glancing at the problem, that Congress members can be unelected, at least in theory, and we could pressure Congress to pass newer, tougher laws. Instead, you have made a calculation to go after the EPA, which is not on its face obviously less corrupt than Congress, is advancing fracking and all sorts of other horrors on us. Why the decision to try to influence the EPA?
Well, a couple of things. One of which is we certainly are in favor of new additional laws that would aim to reduce greenhouse gas pollution. We don't see it as an either-or. Either you have the Clean Air Act or you have some new law. Rather, we see it as a both and. And I think the severity of the crisis indicates we desperately need the both and. So just to, you know, we definitely would favor new strong laws to reduce greenhouse gas pollution. But we also, you know, having a reality check of our current congressional state, it doesn't seem like that's going to happen this term. And I think the second calculation is that even if it were to happen, there's a whole lot we can be doing under the Clean Air Act. And while we are very disappointed in a lot of the measures and taken by the EPA in terms of what happened in terms of fracking, the fracking investigations in Demick, Pennsylvania, and Pavilion, Wyoming, et cetera, and abandoning those investigations and turning them over to the state, and many other things, you know, we still believe that this, you know, there is a lot of good intent within the EPA, and it is both pressuring them and providing them the support to move. So both things are the goal of this campaign. And given all of that, we really do think that in the short run, you know, the Clean Air Act is where it's at. And we are seeing some movement. We just need more urgent movement, and we need more ambition. So the next big rule coming down the pipe in terms of the Clean Air Act is we have a rule that was just released around future power plants, limiting greenhouse gas pollution from future power plants. They are working on a rule to limit greenhouse gas pollution from existing power plants, and they need to be working urgently, and they need to make those rules have all of the ambition that is necessary to reduce greenhouse gas pollution to no more than 350 parts per million, which is the level scientists say, you know, we need to get to in order to have some real chance of having a livable climate as we move forward and limiting warming to less than 2 degrees Celsius. And I'm sure, as a lot of your listeners know, we just surpassed 400 parts per million, so we have a lot of work to do. It's urgent. The Clean Air Act is on the books. We know how it works. It's worked for 40 years. They've been given authority by the Supreme Court to use it. They're starting to use it. Let's push them and support them to use it with the urgency that's required.
Well, I love the idea of enforcing existing laws. We have a lot of good laws that are not being enforced, and this is clearly one of them, and it's clearly having some resonance with city councils around the country that are passing these resolutions. How can people pass one in their city or town or perhaps state? Are states on the agenda, or is the U.S. Conference of Mayors on the agenda? Where can people take this, and how can they participate?
Well, we have a toolbox on our website. If you just do cleanaircities.org, you can go to our Take Action toolbox, which has a sample resolution. We have a map with all the cities that have passed the resolutions, and you can click on that city and see the exact resolution passed by that city council or county council or whoever in that community. Most of these are cities. We have some counties on board. We have a step-by-step guide. And the other thing is, we are available. Myself and a number of volunteers here are running this campaign, and so we're available to help you and your community figure out who might on your city council or county board be a good sponsor for a resolution. How can you go talk to them? We can help turn out our members and supporters to a city council meeting or have them send emails of support or make calls of support. And in some communities, you know, having a great champion, and once you've identified that champion, then it moves forward. In other communities, we have to do a lot more mobilization, and it varies widely, but basically there's a toolbox, should have everything you need there, and we are really happy to help you and support you in getting it through your city council. And while thus far we've very much focused on cities and some counties, we also would love it if states came on board and started passing similar resolutions. We believe that the broader base of support that we can show to the EPA, to the Obama administration, and to the right wing who are pushing back on these regulations and others, you know, we need to, the broader base of support we can show, the more powerful, obviously, the use of the Clean Air Act can be.
I'm just thinking out loud that online activist groups like Roots Action, which I work for, could ask hundreds of thousands of people to email their state legislators, but we don't have a system set up for emailing your city council members. So we might have to talk about that in the future, about whether we can help. At the moment, the government is still supposedly shut down, or the half of it that does any good for anybody is shut down. What happens to the EPA during a time like this? Is the EPA closed up or functioning, or is it a free ride for polluters until the government reopens?
Unfortunately, it's much closer to the latter. So we're missing important work on these rules. You know, it does take time to develop these rules to limit greenhouse gas pollution. That's on hold. We just saw this massive oil spill fracked crude in North Dakota that went undetected for days, at least partially due to the government shutdown that stopped regulators from even looking for such things. We know that while you know, our parks are shut down and our public lands are shut down to access by the public, we know that oil and gas development, you know, drilling and fracking, et cetera, are still going on or allowed to go on. So it is kind of the worst of both worlds, and it is a huge problem that the EPA is essentially shut down right now when it needs to be moving really urgently. I'm sure you all, a lot of your listeners, saw the reports out of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change a few weeks ago, again reiterating the crisis we're facing, but also noting that we still have time to avert it, although not much time. So the urgency, the severity of this crisis is really, it keeps hitting us over the head, and now we need the action to match that reality.
Yeah, it makes me wonder whether there aren't some powerful, wealthy forces in this country that aren't terribly upset with the shutdown, because they've shut down the things that that polluters, among other destroyers of our society, don't want open anyway. The United States military is, of course, not shut down, and correct me if I'm wrong, is the biggest consumer of oil that we've got. Is the EPA, when it is up and running, able to regulate pollution by the U.S. military, which of course happens all around the globe, not just within the borders of the United States?
Well, the EPA does have powers, you know, fairly broad authority to deal with a lot of these issues. And I think what we've seen is two things. One is we've definitely seen budget cutbacks at the EPA, which no doubt affect and impact their ability to deal with these grave problems. And we've also seen, you know, as you pointed out earlier and talking about the fracking reports that have, you know, really been buried by the EPA, the evidence of water contamination that the EPA found and then abandoned before making final findings, et cetera. So we've also seen, you know, the impact of some of the pushback on the EPA in regard to that. So it is definitely the worst of both worlds. And, you know, we're hoping through campaigns like this one that we can, as I said, both support the EPA where it's doing good and push the EPA to do a whole lot better.
What is the EPA's budget, $8 or $9 billion?
You know, I'm not familiar with the latest figures, but, you know, I think if you look at the EPA's budget in regard to the profits made by companies like Exxon, et cetera, you can see the way in which we do need to support the EPA, and it does need to be funded. And I think it would be funded, actually, it would have a lot more support for additional funding if the EPA, you know, acted always, or at least 99% of the time, you know, in the interest of aggressive, ambitious action to reduce these threats.
Well, I'm certain it's less than the $1 trillion or so that militarism gets from our government each year.
Oh, I'm certain of that too. No doubt about it.
Which is up and running. And there's a wonderful action on the website of biologicaldiversity.org about military base construction in Okinawa and the damage that does.
We've been fighting that base for a long time, and the community there has been 100-year-old grandmas, you know, at the sit-ins near this proposed expansion of the U.S. military air base there. And we will win that eventually. We've won this far in keeping that military base from expanding for many, many years.
That is wonderful.
You are correct. These battles are long-lived. They don't go away easily.
In this campaign, you gave a better website than I had been giving, cleanaircities.org. Have you run into opposition? Have you run into arguments against using the Clean Air Act? Are there cities that have rejected this idea?
Yes, certainly there have been. You know, we've had folks, you know, who don't support that. And who are, you know, fighting, who have not come forward or have refused to come forward or said they would not do it. So there's no doubt there is that opposition out there to opposition to regulation, opposition to the EPA, opposition to the existence of climate change. You know, there's a broad range of opposition. But having said that, I think if you do look at the communities we have gotten, you know, very industrial cities like that you might be surprised by, because they're, you know, you think about regulation and industry and, you know, oh, these, you know, jobs, and it is a false dichotomy. And I think cities like Gary, Indiana, and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, who are part of this Clean Air Cities campaign that are super industrial bases, right, for many, many years, who are nonetheless saying, you know, we support use of the Clean Air Act, and we support it urgently and ambitiously to reduce greenhouse gas pollution to no more than 350 parts per million. You know, so if you look at the broad, we've been very pleased by the broad list of cities, you know, Nashville, Tennessee, Yonkers, New York, you know, West Hollywood, you know, some very usual suspects and some pretty unusual suspects on our list.
Do you have a goal for how many cities to get, or a plan to at certain point to to have a real world event where you bring mayors and city council members together, or what's the next stage if the cities keep piling up and there's not action?
Well, each city, after they pass a resolution, in the resolution itself, it directs the city clerk to send the copy of the resolution to President Obama and to the EPA administrator. So those are going in as they're coming in, and we also would like to get to 100 cities and have a very big event to deliver all of these resolutions en masse. The other thing I think this has done is, you know, when each city passes a resolution, it gives us the opportunity, having worked with the city council there, having worked with advocates on the ground there, to get a little bit of media attention and the local press for the effort. So it both exposes, again, the crisis of climate change and exposes, I think, to some people for the first time, the solution that we already have on the books in the Clean Air Act and how powerful it can be. And so these goals are ongoing as we continue to amass cities across the country.
And it seems like the momentum has to get moving, as the argument from city council members that it's none of their business and they should butt out and they don't have time seems weaker the more other cities have already done it. So people can go to their city council now and say, would you like to join 72 cities that have already done this? And all you're doing is asking that existing law be enforced. It seems like the sort of thing that most reasonable, rational city councils around the country ought to be willing to do.
I would agree. And in some places, it can be that simple, which is you find a city council person who understands the crisis of climate change. You find a city council person who's not afraid to make a statement on national policy that clearly affects their community. You know, we do hear from time to time a city saying, well, we don't take positions on national issues. And for us, that really is a false dichotomy, because these issues, when Miami, Florida is underwater, the fact that the EPA did not act as urgently and ambitiously as needed in using the Clean Air Act to reduce greenhouse gas pollution is Miami's business. I'm sorry, that's going to affect Miami. And I think we're seeing more and more cities disregarding that argument that it's not our place to make a statement. And clearly, the more cities we have on board, the broader array of cities we have on board, little cities, big cities, West Coast, South, East Coast, North, Midwest, I think you're going to see that change even more.
It's a wonderful campaign, very encouraging. People who want to get involved can go to cleanaircities.org. Also, check out biologicaldiversity.org. We have been speaking with Rose Braz, who is the Climate Campaign Director for the Center for Biological Diversity's Climate Law Institute. Rose, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much for covering the campaign and all your work. Thank you.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.